Okay, guys, let's get started. Our numbers are severely diminished, I see, since the first lecture. I'll assume that's just because it's a rainy day and not because our lectures are terrible. Let's hope. So today we'll be discussing indirect benefits of sociality. This is in contrast to perhaps the examples that you will have seen in some of Damien's lectures about the direct benefits and the reasons that animals group. But just so I get a sense myself of what you guys remember and what was covered, can you give me some examples of reasons that animals form groups or collectives? What is the sort of stuff you went over previously that gives you ideas about why animals get together in groups? Hunting, yeah? So in what way? What do they do in groups to hunt? Any examples that you remember? Leopards, maybe. Certainly wild dogs, lions hunt in groups. And so there's obviously direct benefits to prey capture, these kind of processes, yeah? Anything else? Distracting predators, yeah? So how do they, in what's the sort of process? Technically we call that predator confusion. Yeah, so the predator is unable to focus on one prey item. Yep. Territory defense, for instance. Yep. Good. Yep. The energy saving, maybe an aspect. Good. The many eyes effect or increased vigilance. Good. Excellent. Now, the important part of those processes is that it's directly beneficial to every member of the group. The benefits may not be equal, right? Some members may gain more than others, but every member is there because it's better to be in a group than it is to be alone, yeah? It's easier to hunt in a group in some species when you're in a group than it would be if you were that same species and be alone. In the predator confusion effect, absolutely. You're much easier located or followed if you're alone for some fish than you are if you're in a group. Territory defense or any kind of defense may be better if you're in a group, so it's better to be part of a group. What do we have? Energetic savings, absolutely. You're not going to be saving the same kind of energy in terms of turbulence and airflow if you're alone than if you're in a group. And the many eyes effect, by definition, the more things that are seeing, the better it is. So it's always better to be part of these groups because of something that you get right then and there. That's what we term direct benefits, yeah, or proximate benefits of being in a group. But there's another type of benefit, which is this indirect benefit. And this comes as a, initially, a very confusing evolutionary process because a lot of these indirect benefits seem at the proximate level, at the direct level, to be bad for the animals that are forming these groups. And so early on, in fact, it was Darwin who once pointed it out, probably not the first, that he said this idea of altruism, of doing something that's not beneficial to you but benefits some other individual, is potentially fatal for his whole theory of evolution. Yeah. So it was a big problem and it's received a lot of research attention. Some would argue, I would argue, disproportionately large amounts of research effort directed to this question of indirect benefits. But nevertheless, it's an important process and one that needs to be understood. Okay, so here's a little summary of what I just said. The important point is this. When benefits are accrued to the individual, that means they are received by that individual, the benefits are said to be direct. Yeah, direct benefits, for instance, your predation risk is lower, your energy output is lower, your success at hunting is higher, or your per capita energy intake is higher. These are direct benefits. And probably most of the things you've seen in the lectures previously are direct benefits, and many of the sort of collective or group level behaviors that you imagine immediately are probably based in direct benefits. One point that I should make early on is this difference. direct versus indirect fitness. So unfortunately, there's two sets of terminology which are similar. Direct and indirect benefits are about what's happening to you right there and then. Okay, so direct benefits, you gain something like we just discussed, whereas indirect benefits might be something that you get later or via some other process. Direct and indirect fitness are terms that apply specifically to the way genes are passed on. And this is an important aspect of this discussion. Okay, so if this is ever unclear to you, the difference between direct and indirect benefits and direct and indirect fitness, please stop me, raise your hand, and we'll talk about it, because this is an important point. Luckily, you guys just gave me all of these examples, which is great. In case you hadn't done, we would have had to talk about this. This is the selfish herd, which means that it's better to be part of a group because it's likely that somebody else in the group will be eaten, kind of like what we were talking about over here. Information exchange, one we didn't talk about. So if some individual within the group finds a food source or finds something useful, maybe a predator, then all can know about it. That's an important process. Vigilance, the many eyes effect, and a lot of other stuff from previous lectures. But when we're talking about this question of direct and indirect benefits, it's important to structure it in a sort of logical way. And then we can form one of these kind of matrices where we look at the types of social interactions that can occur. And this gets very quickly into game theory and evolutionary bargaining type of arguments, which is a big field in itself, but we'll just summarize it quickly here. And so here we have the recipient, okay? That's the one that gets the thing done to them. And the actor, that's the one doing the thing, okay? So if we look at a case where the actor benefits and the recipient benefits, can anyone tell me what kind of process that is? We do something together and it's good for both of us. Yes, definitely those are two cases of this process, but more generally it's cooperation, yeah? But exactly, mutualism and symbioses are two of those processes. Now, we don't have a category here for a neutral interaction, but commensalism would be a neutral form of mutualism. We don't have that on this figure. Okay, whoops. Anyway, there you go, it's up. Okay, so the next type is when the actor is harmed and the recipient benefits. This is a lot of what we're going to talk about today. This is a process called altruism or altruistic behavior. Can anyone, before we get further into the lecture, think of any examples of altruism? Mm-hmm. Yep. So this is costly to the individual, but someone else benefits. And you raised an interesting or an essential aspect of that argument in what you said. We'll get to that later. Anything else? Any other forms of altruism, even in humans or anything you can think of? I just want to make sure we all understand what altruism is, what we're talking about. Yep. So this is called alloparental care. So it may reduce your energy consumption or your ability to do other things because you're helping raise the offspring of some other individual. Yeah. What about this kind of behavior? The individual doing it benefits, but the individual receiving it is harmed. Selfishness. Yes. The defining trait of humanity. Yeah, selfish behavior. Okay, so this is, I think obviously we all understand. I do something that benefits me, and it doesn't really matter who it harms. Yeah, this is a very common kind of behavior, especially in the sort of harsh reality of the animal kingdom, also in humans. Okay, and then there is this strange case where both the actor and the recipient are harmed. Spite. Yes. Spiteful behavior, yeah? Now, spiteful behavior really is a problem for evolutionary theory, yeah? Because if this is harmful on both sides of the equation, it's very difficult to see a way that that could be maintained by selection. And in the animal kingdom, at least, there's very few examples demonstrated of true spiteful behavior. humans are a little bit different for many reasons, and so spite in humans does exist. Now, to talk about this aspect of indirect processes, we are talking about benefits or costs that accrue not in the immediate sense, not right there and then, but rather accrue over some delayed time window. And this could be generational time, yeah? So it means that the costs or benefits may not accrue to me, but rather to my offspring. The point frequently is that they may not accrue to the individual at all, of course, because they accrue over generational time, but they may accrue to the offspring of that individual, and so may appear to be altruistic in the immediate sense, but have some delayed benefit. And as we touched on here, there are processes in which you may perform behaviors that seem deleterious to you, but benefit your offspring, and they can contribute to both your direct fitness in an indirect way, or they could accrue to your indirect fitness in an indirect way. And we'll get to that in a few slides. A crucial aspect of these delayed benefits is that they require a mechanism by which this benefit is transferred, and almost exclusively that's the mechanism of heredity, in that your genes, your genetic material, is passed down to your offspring or is represented in related individuals if they're not your direct offspring. And so many of the examples that we're going to talk about today are in kin groups. Kin means related or family groups. And that's, of course, because it's within kin groups that you have this heredity structure, such that you are related to those individuals by definition. However, we will also talk about processes of reciprocity among kin, but also among non-kin. Reciprocity is the process by which I do something to you, and then later you do something to me. That could be a bad thing or a good thing. In English, we have a statement, a phrase, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. And this sort of sums it up. I'll do something for you if you do something for me. And then we may not need any of these processes of relatedness to come into play, but rather it's a delayed benefit or an indirect benefit to me that comes subsequently because of something I've done. Importantly, it could appear that what I'm doing is altruistic, but the benefit may come later on. So in fact, it's not altruistic. It's not globally a cost to me, just the benefit that I gain is delayed or not immediately apparent. There is a big question here that I'm happy to discuss as to whether altruism exists at all, anywhere, both in humans and in the animal kingdom. In the first lecture I gave you, we talked about the selfish gene hypothesis, and this idea of selection acting at the level of the gene. Don't worry so much about this mnemonic just yet. This word just means a thing that helps you remember something. Well, a very difficult word to remember in itself, which I find funny. But this idea of the selfish gene means that an organism like we are, that moves around and carries copies of genes, is not the thing that's maintained by selection, not the thing that persists in the evolutionary process. Rather, it's the genes that are inside each organism that are carried through generations, or copies of those genes, rather. And so what that means is there can be behaviors that are bad for the animal, if we're talking about animals, but good for some of the genes within that animal, that can still persist. Yeah? And so we may have a behavior or some kind of process that looks on the face of it to be a bad process, but there are indirect benefits at the level of maybe all genes, maybe a subset of genes, that mean that behavior can persist through time and be selected for and maintained in the evolutionary process. And for indirect benefits, this idea of kin selection or inclusive fitness or selection at the level of the gene is an important aspect to keep in mind, because it keeps you thinking about the fact that we're not thinking, or we shouldn't be thinking about the individual, the person or the animal, and the behaviors that they show in the context of that individual, but rather in the context of the genes that compose that individual and that that individual carries. So let's talk then about this process of altruism and how it could possibly evolve a little bit more. So this process of kin selection and altruism was, of course, as I said, first discussed by Darwin, and not him only, of course, much earlier, but it was really popularized by these two people. This is a guy called Bill Hamilton, and this is Richard Dawkins. So before Richard Dawkins went a bit crazy and started writing about religion and how Islam is evil, he actually wrote some very good books. The Selfish Gene was the first among those, which summarizes and discusses those points that I just raised, that selection operates at the level of genes and not at the level of individuals. This was met with some very fierce criticism at the time, but has since become widely accepted as the most common process by which evolution occurs. And the important aspect here is that selection, as I have just said, favors the genes, but it really doesn't care how those genes are passed on. You know, it doesn't care how damaging that may be to any other process. It's inherently a very selfish process. The genes only concern, this is very teleological, of course, because genes don't have concerns, but the only thing that matters to the gene is how many copies of that gene are left in subsequent generations. That's the process of natural selection. And so we can have some strange ways by which genes get through subsequent generations that may appear a little bit counterintuitive if we look at it, but if we understand selection at the level of the gene, it's obvious that these things can occur. Okay, so then let's get into some examples of apparently deleterious behaviors, but ones, if we understand this selection at the level of the gene, that start to make a lot of sense in light of evolution. And the first is parental investment. Okay, we had two examples of parental investment, one on alloparental care and one of the self-sacrifice to preserve young. And this is exactly what occurs in many, many species. It can be fairly minor, all the way up to very extreme investment in offspring. Any investment in offspring, for instance, humans or any kind of mammals lactating, providing breast milk to their offspring, is an energetic loss on the part of the parent that constitutes an energetic gain on the part of the offspring. Yeah? So if we look at our matrix that we saw before, the actor is harmed, it loses energy, and the recipient benefits, it gains energy. And in our little matrix, that was altruism. Yeah? In the cases where it's a minor investment, like feeding of young or guarding them or not doing something as you would like because you're looking after your offspring, that's one case. But this investment can be terminal. Terminal investment means it's fatal. It's the last thing you do. And in some spiders, which I'll show you a video just now, this process occurs when the mother spider allows the baby spiders to kill her and eat her in some pretty gruesome ways. So as we watch this video, I want you to think about this question. Is this behavior altruism? Can you see this, or should I turn off the lights? You see it, more or less? We'll do that. Okay, so here we have the lovely mother. If anyone's afraid of spiders, too bad. And here are her lovely cute little babies. And she carries around the eggs and guards them. And then once the spiderlings hatch out, they just swarm all over her body in what may otherwise look like they're feeding in the same way as a pig, but in fact they're not feeding on milk, they're just consuming her hemolymph, her flesh and her organs. And you can see her shriveled abdomen here as these fat little babies suck her juices out. A lovely example of biology. Oh, this one looks good. Spider explodes with baby spiders. Let's have a look at that. Okay, so this is a different process, actually. This is a wolf spider. These have a very high degree of parental investment and parental care, but this is just guarding the babies from damage. These spiderlings are not consuming their mother. Rather, she's just protecting them. Okay, back we go. So, is this, in your opinion, an altruistic behavior? Is it an altruistic behavior in the immediate sense? Yes. We're all happy? Who says yes? Who says no? So, in the immediate sense, it's altruism, yeah? The mother suffers greatly, eaten alive by her babies. And the babies benefit because they get to eat their mother. But is there some kind of benefit to the mother? And so what would that do to the genes in the mother, or the copies of the genes in the mother? Okay, so then if we think about selection at the level of the gene, this selfish gene idea, and we're talking about the gene on that matrix, or copies of the gene, because remember, copies of the gene are equivalent to that gene, right? They're literally copies. So if we put the gene on that matrix, does the gene now benefit from this behavior? Or does the gene suffer? This is an important point. I'm not going to move on until we're all on board here. So let's think about it. We have one copy of the gene in the mother. Let's call it gene X, okay? Gene X is in the copy of is in the mother in two copies, yeah, because she's diploid, as you said, but there are 300 babies. And so now there are 600 copies of that gene there in the world. The gene, let's just do the haploid case, okay? The mother has one and each baby has one. The gene in the mother dies effectively by her letting herself be eaten. But now, because she died, there are 300 more copies of that gene out in the world that have a much better chance of survival and producing copies for themselves. So the behavior of self-sacrifice in this case benefits the gene greatly. Yeah? Yes? So at the level of the gene, is this altruistic? No, it's not. Because the gene does not suffer. There's no cost to the gene because it benefits. It benefits in the only way the genes care about, which is having more of themselves. This is an important point. I'll probably put it in the exam. Does everybody understand this? Yeah? It looks like altruism. Well, the problem is that genes don't behave. So you shouldn't really call it altruistic or anything, but the important point is it's not a bad thing for the gene. It's not deleterious for the gene. It certainly doesn't sit in that category in that matrix. Yeah? Okay, so the answer is she doesn't die giving birth, no, because she lays her eggs and she protects those eggs and she still feeds, and then when they've hatched out, she allows herself to be eaten. There are some cases where it's an ongoing choice. For instance, in some cichlid fish, the fish that I study, parents will stop feeding once they've had offspring and just guard the offspring. Even if food comes very near to them, they just won't eat it. So they're continually making a choice to die, effectively. So in this case, it is a behavior, but what if it wasn't? If there were an organism that always died during childbirth, for instance, and by virtue of dying, the children ate it. Or let's say there's some imaginary alien animal, and it gets pregnant, and the baby starts to eat it from the inside and kill it. Yeah? Even though it's not a behavioral choice at the level of the animal, selection would still be operating on that animal to keep doing this way of dying, or not, depending on which one gave greater fitness benefits. So even if it's not a behavioral decision at the level of the animal, selection doesn't care. It operates on the genes that encode certain either active behavioral pathways or other processes that come to the same outcome. So it is an interesting question, but I don't think it matters as much how death is manifested in this case for this process. Okay, that's a bit morbid, that conversation, so let's talk about some nicer things. But this is roughly the same process, to be honest. I think now that you've got the idea, you'll start to see that these processes are all pretty similar. So here's a very terrible figure, but it's the best one I could find. It's in one of the major books that we have on this topic. And here we have the process of inclusive fitness. Okay, so here's where we get to that problem about indirect, direct, inclusive, direct fitness, which is not the same as the direct benefits. Direct fitness is the process here where you produce offspring. Yeah, you have children, they contribute to your direct fitness. There is another thing called indirect fitness, which is offspring that you, well, they don't have to be offspring, which are copies of the gene that are not descended from you, but are the same as your copies. Now, what's the obvious way that those things would occur? In your brothers and sisters or your cousins. You are not their mother or father, but they share genes with you. Those genes compose indirect fitness benefits to you because they are genes in common, but not through descent. This won't be in the exam, but it's an important topic. Yeah? Together, direct and indirect fitness comprise your inclusive fitness, which is the sum of all the things you produce and that are produced by others that share your genes. Let me go over it again. You are related to your brother and sister by 0.5. That means half of the genes in your brothers and sisters are the same as the genes in you. Yeah? So, actually, I think I have a slide. Yes, here we go. This is exactly the slide that I was looking for, almost like I wrote this talk myself. Here's you. You're related to your mum and to your dad by 0.5, and you're related to your aunties and uncles, which are your mother and father's siblings, by 0.25. This means that 25% of your genes probabilistically are shared by your auntie. Your cousin is less related to you because your auntie mated with somebody else that's unrelated to you, hopefully. And so they are less related to you, and then your siblings are related to you by 0.5. Now, this fellow, JBS Haldane, said, apparently, but even if he didn't, it's a good illustration, I would gladly give up my life for two sibs, that means brothers or sisters, or eight first cousins. That's these. Why on earth would he say such a thing? Okay, here's another way to pose this question to you. I'm sure you've seen on the internet these choice things where you have five people on a train track on one side and one person on a train track on another, and you either do nothing and five people die, or you pull a lever and one person dies, but you kill that person by participating in that act. Yeah? I know this lecture's a bit dark. I'm sorry about that. We'll get to some nice animal behavior soon. This is the same kind of question. If I'm sitting, I'm having a family picnic down at the Rheinstrandbad, yeah, right? I said that right, good. And I'm there with three of my brothers, which I don't have three brothers, but anyway, let's say I did. And two of them fall in the water and start drowning. Two of them, yeah? No, one of them. Okay, let's start with one. One of my brothers goes into the water and he's drowning. Genetically, just genetically, should I jump in and save him if it'll kill me? No? So the answer is I share only 50% of my genes with my brother. And how many of my genes do I share with myself? 100%. Good. You're awake. Good. So I lose 50%. Yeah? My cost is 50%. That's not, it's a silly way of talking about it, but basically that's the idea. Okay. I think we got it now. But how about two brothers? Two of my brothers are drowning. I could get in, save them, but I'll die. Should I do it? At the level of my genes. Yeah, but I've also got 100%, right? Yeah. So for instance, they may have more offspring or something later, or just good to have more people around. Sure. These are equivalent though, right? I could do it. I could not. It's a level of a gene. It's the same. Okay. Three brothers. Yes. I should probably sacrifice my own life for my three stupid brothers that are drowning. Yeah? That's at the level of the gene. Now, it's interesting, of course, if you think about that in a realistic sense, and you ask any mother or father if they would sacrifice their life to save their son or daughter, and they would probably say yes. Genetically, it makes no sense. But genes don't control everything, right? And also, over evolutionary time, it may be selected for to sacrifice yourself for your offspring because you're generally going to save them without dying, or, you know, overall it's a better strategy than just letting them to their own devices and dying. Okay, but I think we got this point very well. Which brings us to our next point. If we formalize that argument, which this fellow did, Bill Hamilton, I'm going to give you a little insight to some of these characters as we come across them. Bill Hamilton is one of my favorite biologists because he was one of the worst lecturers and presenters ever. He was incredibly shy. Almost couldn't form a sentence. And yet he came up with this beautiful theorem called Hamilton's rule, which changed the way we think about evolution and animal behavior. And yet it is almost certain that he would never get a job as a lecturer in even the worst university in the world in this day and age. I think that's really important to keep in mind, that some of the ways that we think about science and in the YouTube era, some of these people are getting sort of ignored, which is tragic. So this guy is a legend, Bill Hamilton. Also, he refused to take malarial medication when he would do his field work in Africa, and it killed him, which I think is also kind of heroically stupid. But he believed that he was going to survive malaria, and he didn't. Okay, here's the formal way we formulate this relationship. So the cost to the donor has to be less than the benefit of altruism multiplied through by that coefficient of relatedness. Yeah? And so if your behavior, the thing you do, gives some benefit to the recipient, but you give that benefit to a lot of recipients such that the overall function outweighs the cost to you, altruism should evolve. Yeah? This was formulated in the 60s, and up until then, for 160 years, more or less, this process of altruism was a problem for evolutionary theory. It was a real big problem because it didn't make any sense. So this is a very important theorem. So keep this in mind. This is the cost to the donor or the actor, the one doing it. This is the benefit that the recipient gets. It may be that they get saved from drowning, it may be something else. And this is the coefficient of relatedness, how related they each are. Before we have a little break, this is the major point. Genes might ensure their evolutionary success by favoring relatives at a cost to themselves. So there can be strategies, there can be reasons that animals get into groups, there can be reasons that animals do certain behaviors that are based in this relationship, that it may be evolutionarily better to do something that is terrible for you as an individual, but benefits the copies of your genes in some other individuals. Okay, so now let's talk about examples of kin selection. Okay, we went over the theory. I think we all are on board with that. I'm pleased to see that. So now let's now talk about examples. Okay, so we talked about parental care. So we've been there. Cooperative breeding when helpers are related. Okay, so this is a process in which I help my parents or my siblings or some others to breed even if I'm not breeding. This is a very well-studied phenomenon. Then we come to the eusocial insects, things like termites, bees, ants, wasps, which have a very particular genetic composition called haplodiploidy, which means their relatedness is higher than normal. Some individuals are related by 0.75. In fact, some of the animals I studied are clonal. They're related by one. And so that changes this sort of altruism dynamic very much, especially in terms of the genes that are shared. We'll come to this in a later lecture, but I just want to mention it here, which is also coalitions of males. Brothers may form bands and do courtship displays to the females such that one of them gets to mate. Even if all of them don't get to mate, at least your brother mated, and so you'll have some related offspring at some point. All right, so let's talk about kin-directed altruism, and let's watch a little movie of these cute furry animals that aren't dying or killing each other, prairie dogs. So here we have some naughty foxes coming to eat something. And here we have these, really would be good to have the sound because they make noises. I know you can't hear this. Okay, but so this, blah, blah, blah.
To often fall silent, to call out now could prove fatal. If a pup does indeed learn from its parents, then knowing when to hold fire and retreat could be one of the most valuable lessons of its life. Experiencing
Okay, we don't need to see them doing strange stuff. Point is, in this system, these prairie dogs, they're hunted by these foxes. Now, and they form these territories, not the foxes, the prairie dogs, where there's a lot of them all together in this system. And when they see one of these foxes, they'll stand up like this and they'll start to call. This animal is calling. I won't do the call, but it's like a little squeak, yeah? When the fox comes too close, the point of this video is that they all fall silent because it's very, very dangerous. If you make a call like this, the fox is very likely to find you and kill you, as it's shown later in the video. And so it's clearly costly to make these alarm calls. It's a very dangerous thing to do because it brings the attention of the predator to you. Yeah? And so the question is, under what conditions would you do these alarm calls? Why on earth would you be the one to put yourself at risk by saying, hey, there's a fox? Why wouldn't you let some other individual make this call? So let's think about this. What would happen if nobody ever made alarm calls? Would that benefit the group? Would there be any benefit to being in the group? So you said, up the back, you said this increased vigilance effect, yeah? That one individual will be likely to find a predator in a group. But if that individual that sees the predator does nothing, is there any benefit? No, there's no benefit, yeah? So if in the case that no individuals are signaling that there's danger, then there's actually no benefit in terms of predation avoidance of being in a group. So that wouldn't work. So somebody has to signal. But who should signal? For me, if there's some danger in the room and you all see it, it's behind me, let's say, some monster, and it's about to eat us, and one of you says, hey, there's a monster, but by doing so, it kills you, that's very bad for you. It's very good for me because I don't die. Yeah? And so that illustrates the point that it's better to be selfish. Now, remember our figure? It's better to be selfish. Let some other individual do the thing so that you benefit from it. This is also called the tragedy of the commons, where if there's some common resource, it's better to let some other entity suffer, or at least not for you to suffer. Yeah? Climate change is an embodiment of the tragedy of the commons. It's better if we all stop polluting, but it's the absolute worst thing to do to be the first one that stops polluting while everybody else continues to pollute. Yeah? This is how Donald Trump runs his politics, unfortunately. In some systems, you can have global control and make everyone do stuff. But unless you do, individuals will act selfishly, will have a tendency to. Same in this case. So can you think, given what we've just talked about and what the title of this slide is, of any situation in which it would still be better to make these alarm calls? No? It's always a bad idea? Yep. Yes. If the others in your group are related to you, and by exposing yourself to danger in which you might die, you are allowing others in your group a higher chance of survival, and those others in your group carry your genes, then this behavior can be selected for. And that's exactly what this shows. Okay, so here we have, this is a study that was done with these prairie dogs. So they've got kin, related individuals in their group or not in their group. We have males and females, that's not so important. And then you have this simulated badger attack on this group. And here we're just looking at the orange bar is how many calls you give when you're with kin and how many calls you give without kin. Yeah? And so all you're seeing here is that you're far more likely to make one of these alarm calls if you're around your brothers and sisters and parents, likely because it will benefit them and their survival in a way that outweighs the cost to you. Yeah? Can anyone think of a reason why they would be giving calls even when they're not with kin? Yeah, cool. That's called terminal investment. If you've got nothing else to lose, you may as well throw it all on the table. Yeah? Any other thoughts about how... This is a very complex question, so don't worry. But how do genes control behavior? How does selection and behavior, how does behavior evolve? The answer comes down to the fact that this situation is incredibly rare. It almost never exists for these animals, except in this experiment. And so evolution has not been able to produce a response like this, that an animal would be sensitive to having this situation, yeah, so that it would drop its calls to zero. So probably these animals have some baseline calling rate, which is generally a good idea because generally they're in this scenario. But it is a bit sensitive to some degree, which we would call plasticity. So this is a plastic response. It means a flexible response. But the behavior itself is encoded by genes that are the subject of selection over evolutionary time. This is more evidence for this same process, looking at the number of times they give a call, depending on which life stage they're at. And so this gets to a question we just talked about down here. So if you're living in the place you were born, you may be more likely to give calls because you're more likely to be related to those individuals versus times when you've moved away to a new place, you've emigrated, but you don't yet have offspring in that place. So here, you're not likely to call as highly because you're probably not related to those individuals, so you don't care if they die. It's very selfish. Versus when you do have offspring, and this special case when you've been evicted. So just the same process again. Take-home message is that you are more likely to perform altruistic behaviors if those behaviors are more likely to benefit individuals to which you're related. The next case we'll talk about is cooperative breeding. And so this is a case where you may be living in a group where some individuals are producing offspring, but you yourself are not producing offspring. So this means you have zero direct fitness. Direct fitness is that component of fitness that comes from your own offspring that you've produced. So you have zero fitness because you're not reproducing, only the dominant individuals, whether they're meerkats, some kind of bird or some other kind of bird, are reproducing, and you're helping them reproduce. You're defending the territory, you're catching food, you're looking after the young. Now, I think we're far enough along in this lecture that you could already answer the question why this would happen. So let's try. Why on earth would you help to rear the offspring of your parents and siblings and not produce any of your own? Because of the indirect fitness benefits of doing so that contribute to your inclusive fitness. So it's an altruistic act on the face of it, but the genetic and delayed benefits are very high. So that's why it could be retained. And just to give you an example, here we have, again, my beautiful cichlids. This is in Lake Tanganyika. And these individuals are helpers, as is this individual. They're big enough to breed. They're big enough to move out of the territory and form their own groups, but they don't. They stay here and they help their parents. They may not even be their parents, in fact, but they help these other individuals breed. And there's a great deal of research from some of my friends at the University of Bern looking into this process here by which individuals will remain helpers at nest. This is Neolamprologus multifasciatus. This is one of my study species that I have, I don't know, 10,000 of just up in the Z building. And again, they do the same process where they form these long-term stable groups where they help each other rear offspring, which is a very nice, cute thing to do. Okay, but let's look at some data on this. And we'll just go to this more complex slide. Here you have different components of fitness in this system, the Pied Kingfisher, in which you have different kinds of helpers and the different aspects of their fitness. So here, Y is the number of extra offspring produced by your parents because you're helping your parents. R is the relatedness coefficient, so how related you are to that individual. And F1 is fitness in year one, and F is fitness in year two. So this is this inclusive fitness term. And so you'll notice this has a form that we came across earlier, which is the number of individuals, which is the benefit, multiplied through by their relatedness, which will compose your inclusive fitness. So in the first year, for a primary helper, which is one that's related to the parents, it's quite clear why you would help, right? Because you get some fitness benefit. But what about these individuals? These individuals get no benefit whatsoever in terms of inclusive fitness. But if they stay and help in the first year, that is, they don't leave, then in the second year, we see that they actually get a great inclusive fitness benefit. So not only can the rewards or the benefit of these kind of behaviors be manifested in the future, but they can be manifested a long way into the future by virtue of you being around, in this case, long enough to behave in a way that will be beneficial to you. And this is an important point as well. The benefits of the behavior that you're seeing may actually be zero, both in terms of the direct benefits and in terms of your indirect benefits, but they may allow you to stay in a location or a situation that in the future you're able to do something that is beneficial. So the important thing is to look at animal behavior not as an immediate process to understand the costs and benefits in that specific time, but rather over the course of the lifetime of the animal. This can be very challenging, especially experimentally and in research, because we could put an animal in a situation, measure that it does something that looks wrong, but we're just not looking at the right time scale. Yeah? And how you achieve that and deal with that is actually very challenging. We talked about meerkats. This is the same story, so I'm going to skip over it. And we'll move straight to eusociality. Some people call this the peak of sociality. Because individuals are really not acting for themselves, but they're acting for the good of the group, the hive, the colony, the community. And I think you're all very familiar with these animals, but I'll just make the point in that they have what are called castes of non-reproductive individuals. So you probably all know that most of these eusocial insects have a queen. Often she's very ugly, and she will just produce offspring continuously. She's the only one that's producing offspring. In a honeybee colony, it's a single queen. In fire ants, for instance, there's multiple queens. In other species, there could be some other mixes. But the workers themselves do not reproduce. And so they have zero direct fitness. They are purely altruistic. And this was a thing that bothered Darwin a great deal. How on earth could selection and evolution produce such a system in which you have 20,000 individuals, in the case of some honeybee colonies, and only one of them is reproducing, and the rest are building comb, collecting food, looking after the offspring that are not their offspring, somebody else's offspring. And in the case of many of these animals, sacrificing themselves in the defense effort, right? You know that if a honeybee stings you, the sting tears out and the animal dies. Does anyone know why that would be necessary? This is an important aspect. So in wasps can sting you multiple times. And we know that, we're about to learn that this summer when all these guys come and bother us. They can sting you multiple times, but honeybees sting only once. And the sting rips off into you and tears their guts out. Why does this happen? Seems like a very stupid idea, doesn't it? Obviously, you can sting and not die, but honeybees don't do that. So let's think about animal behavior. Let's think about costs and benefits. Is there any benefit to the sting ripping out and staying inside you? Exactly. So it's a much more effective deterrent, right? Because it tears out, they're all over you. I used to work in Africa with killer bees, and so you just get covered in these things and they're all just pumping poison, the venom into your body, and very hard to find and get rid of. Whereas a wasp stings you once, but then either you kill it or it flies away, and that's the end of the stinging process. So it's a better thing, I guess, to have a venom delivery apparatus that stays in the victim and continues to pump poison. But it kills the individual. And what that should tell you is that relative to the defense of the entire colony, the loss of one individual is effectively meaningless. You can still be a beneficial process at the level of the genes in the colony to kill individuals just so their venom pumps into the attacker a bit longer, if that attacker is then deterred or driven away by that process. And this really touches on this aspect of the very strong indirect benefits of these kind of behaviors in this system. And that is because of this thing, haplodiploidy. So you guys probably have done some genetics courses, maybe Axel's course, I guess, doesn't get into haplodiploidy. But this is just a system that talks about the number of copies of genes or DNA in the system. And so in haploid animals, they have just one copy of each gene. And in diploid animals, they have two. In tetraploid, they have four, and so on and so on. In eusocial insects, the males are haploid and the females are diploid. Yeah? And what that means is if a male mates with a female and produces offspring, those offspring are not now related to one another by 0.5, but by 0.75, because every single offspring gets all of the father's genes, not just half of them. Yeah? And so there's no probabilistic sorting. So you're much more related to one another if you're a eusocial insect or a haplodiploid animal than you are in normal systems. And so that creates this kind of crazy extension of sociality into eusociality, where you get all of this, all of these processes that can be selected for indirectly because of this incredibly high relatedness. And so they look a lot of the time like this. You have just these incredibly high numbers of individuals all working towards one goal, which is to form these incredible structures where you have soldiers on the edges of these swarms. This is driver ants. You have the foragers collecting food. Well, this is a beetle about to get done, I guess. All going out, collecting food, bringing it back to the colony, with the sole purpose of rearing more offspring that are not theirs. And so, as we said, they're very happy, it's the wrong word, but they're very happy to die in an attempt to do something that benefits the colony. Swarming en masse over larger things, biting you, of course, if you come anywhere near them. And it's an incredibly successful strategy. I can't remember exactly, but something like of all the animals in the world, half of them are eusocial insects, and they make up some incredible amount of biomass. Check this on Wikipedia, but it's some crazy numbers like this. and a wide variety of different strategies. Here's a good example of the two castes, these soldiers versus, well, actually, I don't know what's going on, because they shouldn't be killing each other if they're the same species. This looks like termites versus ants. All sorts of cool stuff like this on the internet. But let's get back to science. Oh, there it is. There are more species of social insects than all the birds and mammals combined, which is pretty crazy. Some examples of the different kind of tasks they do. Some of them farm, right? They don't do anything but look after these larders in which they grow fungus. So they'll bring leaves down into the colony, so they grow fungus on which they feed. Some of them will farm aphids, so they'll protect aphids and drink the sweet secretions that they produce. Skip that. We talked about this relatedness here, just to show that when you're getting all of your father's genes, you're much more highly related to one another than in normal systems. Talked about this. Talked about this, fantastic. The point to take home about the eusocial insects, especially those that are haplodiploid, is that you can have extreme cases of altruism in exactly the same way as we discussed with me jumping into the water for my brothers. But because of the relatedness structure in these colonies, it's actually better to forego my own reproduction and rear the offspring of my mother, because I'll be more related, and this sounds crazy, but I'll be more related to my brothers and sisters than I would be to my own offspring. This process means we get all of these crazy types of behaviors that evolve, especially in these haplodiploid organisms. Okay. Now, I want to finish with one more example, which is an important one, which is called reciprocal altruism. This is a process in which animals are not related necessarily, but in which you'll help one another in order for you to get help later. Yeah? This is that process of more like true altruism. So this doesn't have to do with me sacrificing myself for the benefit of my genes. I'm getting direct benefits by these behaviors. I'm just not getting those direct benefits now. This is an important final point because it's very different to all of the others. And the example comes from vampire bats. Let's look at a video of these guys. These guys feed on blood. Next lecture. I'm giving the next lecture as well. I'll try and sort out the sound. Okay, so here we go. They're often found around livestock, but then again, these days, what isn't? And so they'll go and fly onto cows and other ungulates, warm-blooded animals. They'll bite open the skin of these things, and then they'll start to lick out the blood. This is a very dramatic video. But let's hope we see. They're quite ugly animals, to be honest. Are we going to see one drinking the blood? Here we go. So while we're watching this, the important point is these bats have incredibly high metabolisms, and the blood meal that they get are high in protein, but not high in carbohydrate. So they need to get a blood meal every single night, or they will simply starve to death throughout the rest of the day. And that can be very challenging because it may be difficult to find these animals, or it may be difficult to effectively feed on them. And so there's a very great danger in these animals of starving to death. And the way that they've dealt with this problem is they have these communal roosts. Every night they all come back and they live together, they sleep together. Every morning, rather, I should say. And they indicate to one another whether they've had a blood meal or not. And if they haven't, they beg to others, anybody else in the group, They beg to those others for a blood meal, and they'll regurgitate blood and allow that individual to survive. Now, what that means is, of course, that is a very easy way to cheat the system, isn't there? What I should do is just sit around in my cave, wait for everyone else to go out and get a blood meal, and then beg and say, I haven't eaten, please feed me. Yeah? This would be cheating the system, but it's what selfish behavior would probably lead to. But the way that this is avoided is that they've evolved to have individual level recognition. They remember if an individual has begged for food in previous nights, and they are less likely, or they don't feed it if it keeps begging and keeps cheating the system. Yeah, and so this is an important aspect that's been studied, which is to look at recognition of cheats and the processes by which individuals will avoid cheating the system. Nevertheless, when the system, I'm almost done. When the system works, it's an example of reciprocal altruism. Yeah. So I do something, which is I give you a blood meal, and I'm more likely, if I beg from you on a subsequent night, to get a blood meal from you because I shared with you previously. It requires a bunch of processes. For instance, individual recognition. It requires memory. Not all animals have that kind of memory. To work, but when it does work, it's an example of what would probably be considered true altruism in the immediate sense, even if you're benefiting later in the late sense. Okay, let's finish up there. Just to summarize, so in collective behavior and grouping behavior, you may have things that look outwardly similar. You get together in groups because it protects you from predation, you see things, you get information transfer. But the two processes of kin-selected grouping versus direct benefit-selected collective behavior are very, very different. They come about through very different mechanisms. Indirect benefits, all the stuff we talked about today, are probably very rare in the animal kingdom, but they're very well studied because they represented this problem in evolutionary theory. And maybe these collective processes that are defined by direct benefits are far more widespread, even if they're understudied. Okay, guys, remember the prairie dog example, why you would call or not, and that vampire bat example as an example of reciprocal altruism that does not involve genetic processes. Good, I'll see you next week. I'm giving next week's lecture and the week after that as well.